Welcome everyone to East Meets West. I'm Tara Reid and...
And I'm Olga Bataman, joining you this time remotely from Yekaterinburg, which is the capital of the Urals and Pelmenes as well, because I'm covering the InnoProm, which is a big industrial exhibition with foreign participants joining, and Indonesia is the main partner of this industrial exhibition this year. Again, it's about Russia being isolated, but show must go on, so I'm still here with you.
Yeah,
and I mean, there have been so many events for us to discuss, I guess. And first of all, the United States over the weekend celebrated its 250th anniversary. And it's usually the time when we summarize, you know, the results and set the goals for the future. And definitely we'll discuss it with a guest who will be joining us today. But as for me, I don't know, Tara, what you think, but for me, the very celebration this year was a bit weird, I have to say, because first of all, it was marked also by over 30 mass shootings with over 100 killed and 300 injured in the United States. And secondly, it was Trump calling President Putin, which is also a bit unusual. So what do you think of that? How did the United States celebrate its anniversary this year?
Yeah, you know, it's I remember 4th of July bicentennial when I was a child and all the celebrations that happened, and they were much more family oriented and happy. It seemed like there was a somber, almost dark mood in the country. And there were heat waves and all kinds of flooding and other problems with weather. You know, there was a fireworks prohibition in Los Angeles, but then all of Los Angeles lit up with illegal fireworks. It just seemed like there was a disunity. I really didn't feel like there was much unity at all. I think the positive part was President Trump talking to President Putin, because they did say it was positive, at least according to President Putin. He said it was positive and very businesslike. And, you know, so hopefully, you know, it signals peace coming. And now, of course, we know that Trump is in Turkey for the NATO, and there was a very somber picture being taken of all the NATO participants, and nobody looked happy to be there, that was for sure. And, you know, Trump ran on, if you recall, Olga, he said that NATO should be dissolved, and in this I agree with Trump. NATO is not a peacekeeping force. It's been pushing the lines against Russia, and Europe has been pounding its chest with warlike, you know, language towards Russia and funding Ukraine even after the U.S. has stopped. So yeah, I hope that Europe is getting the message that peace is better than war, but time will tell.
You know, as for me, speaking about this telephone conversation that was initiated by President Trump, I think that he called President Putin to get, first of all, firsthand information about the success made by Russia on the front line. And as you may know, Russia has liberated Konstantinovka, which is a strategic point, so to say. It's mm-hmm. crucial. And secondly, also very interestingly, President Putin reminded President Trump about the role of Russia in establishing U.S. statehood. And yes. I guess he was reminding of two events. One was during the war for independence in the United States, when King George III, he asked Yekaterina II to send military support, which Yekaterina II refused to do. And so that's how United States actually got their independence. And the second time was during the war between the North and the South, when Russia actually sent its support, and it helped the United States to preserve its integrity. I think that's what President Putin was referring to.
Very, very fascinating. And you know, what's interesting though is the mood of Europe during the whole this whole conversation that's now continuing regarding Ukraine. Just today and recently, you've been hearing again more rhetoric about a war against Russia. And you know, I think that Trump has made it clear that that's not something that he wants. And also, there's been an unusual amount of legal ramifications for people that are pro-Russia. And in fact, today we have a good friend of ours on the show who's a human rights attorney and who had been, he's an American and he was a law professor and he has written several books. And Dan Kovalik is with us to talk about his experience in the UK. And Olga, I'm so glad that you got a hold of Dan right after, you know, what happened to him, because what a legal overreach for the UK to try to hold an American at the border and take his devices.
And first of all, Daniel, so happy to have you on our show. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm very happy
and
to be
secondly,
here.
Secondly, I honestly
it's great to see both of you.
And I honestly cannot imagine, since you are a peace activist, you are a human rights lawyer, how can the United Kingdom treat you as a terrorist? It's just the opposite to what you are doing. So how do you assess all that? What happened to you?
Yeah, well, so first of all, ironically, I was flying into John Lennon International Airport in Liverpool. And I noted the irony to them. I said, I'm not sure John Lennon would appreciate what you guys are doing. But I also noted to them, and this is true, that John Lennon was on President Richard Nixon's un-American list. He was considered an enemy of the state by President Nixon. Why? Because of his peace activism, you know. For those who live off of war and who are constantly at war, people who advocate for peace are viewed as treasonous. And, you know, so while I'm obviously not happy with what happened, maybe I'm not altogether too surprised, because as the war expands, and it is expanding, we have the war against Iran now, which has fired up again, right? As Tara mentioned, there's indications Europe would like to have a war directly with Russia. They already have one indirectly by proxy with Russia. As the war expands, and these are going to be very unpopular wars, and the Iran war, for example, is very unpopular in the United States. And as you have more economic crises, and that's coming too, in part because of the war, right? You're going to have more dissent. And I think the Western governments are preparing for that. They're going after the advocates, the activists first, right? The leaders, so to speak, right? They're going after those who might lead a mass movement to end the wars and to change the economic dynamics of their countries. And so that's what we're seeing. So in the UK, for example, other folks, now the only folks I know who've been stopped like me were British themselves, like George Galloway, who was, I think you all know very well, he was a Minister of Parliament. You have Craig Murray, also stopped and also now in exile, as George Galloway is. They're both in self-exile. Craig Murray was an ambassador for the United Kingdom, right? And so they're going after, you know, kind of prominent leaders in the peace movement. You know, I'm not going to claim to be prominent, but I guess I'm prominent enough to have gotten their attention, you know, and so that's what I see is happening. So, yeah.
Christopher Halali was also added to a non-fly list, you know, and he was not only not allowed to fly into the United States, but even to fly over the United States. But
Daniel,
you are an American citizen.
Right.
Yeah, he's a U.S. citizen, and he was not even allowed to fly over the United States, over the territory of the United States, and he was flying to Mexico, you know, to support Iranian team at the World Cup. But right. Daniel, since you are an American and that happened in the United Kingdom, who do you think initiated this process? Was that the United Kingdom or was it the United States?
Well, that's a very good question, Olga. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I think it could have been either Britain or the United States. Certainly they work very closely with each other, and their intelligence services work very closely with each other. I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. initiated it, but all, at the same time, the U.K., as I mentioned, is doing this regularly to people. So I also wouldn't be surprised if the U.K. initiated it. I'll probably never know who was behind it.
But Daniel, I was going to ask you about the devices, because you are an attorney. And so your computer and your phone has confidential information on it. They were holding you for anti-terrorism, which peace activists have nothing to do with, you know, weapons or, you know, terrorism. So this is, it's unlike the U.S., where the U.S. kind of accuses people of being spies, right? They'll accuse foreigners of being spies or not registering as FARA. But they don't go so far as to call them terrorists. So the UK seems to be using this label, like on George Galloway and his wife, Richard Medhurst, Chris Halali. So what's going on with that label, number one? And number two, what about your devices and you being a lawyer and having that confidentiality issue?
Yes. Well, in terms of the terrorism,
first of all, have you received your gadget back?
No, not yet. They did contact a colleague of mine in London, a lawyer who I said I would like to speak to when I was detained. And they're going to send those devices back to her and she will send them to me. So no, I have not gotten them back yet. So now, and it was June 27th when I was detained. So it's been, I don't know, 10 days or almost 2 weeks, I guess. In terms of the anti-terrorism laws, the problem with those laws, of course, and the U.S. has its own anti-terrorism laws, most of the Western countries do, they're written overly broad, right? They're written in a way that really they can capture anyone they want to. And that's the danger of them. And that, civil rights, civil liberties activists all along said these are going to be used against non-terrorists. This is going to be used as a political tool against political dissidents, and that's what's happening. So again, the definition of what terrorism is so broad that, for example, we know it's illegal now, a high court ruled in the EU, for people to share videos from RT. That's considered somehow against, I don't know, the terrorism laws or whatever of the EU. Even, by the way, if it's an RT news story about soccer, right? It could be even non-political and you can't share it. That's how crazy things have gotten. Now, in terms of my being an attorney, I did raise the issue. I said, look, I object to my devices being taken, my phone and computer specifically, because they have attorney-client privilege information on there. They have information protected by attorney work product. And they said, well, someone will review that first. A lawyer will review that first before they delve into other stuff. But that's a silliness. They don't know what to even look for. They didn't, what do you look for before you kind of look at everything? There's no way to really do that.
Right.
Daniel, don't you think, since you are an advocate of the Colombian president, don't you think they wanted to get access to some of your information about him, maybe?
Yes, well, I think that that's also a good question. I've of course, wondered if that's true. It could be true. I'll just say what was interesting is that, so they took my phone, they took my computer, they went through my luggage. They pulled out a book on Palestinian children, to question me about that. They were concerned about it. It was a gift that was given to me called Palestine's Children. They took my DNA through cheek swabs. They took my fingerprints. They photographed me. It was like a whole thing. They said, they made a point to say you're not under arrest, but it certainly felt like I was under arrest. But in terms of the interrogation itself, it didn't last very long. And I mentioned Petro because they specifically asked if, you know, I was working, you know, on behalf of a foreign power. And I, you know, you have to be careful. You don't want to lie in these circumstances, right? Because that's where they will really get you. So I said, well, I should say that I do represent the government of Colombia and Gustavo Petro. I said, that's not a secret, you know, but I do. And he didn't really bite at that, by the way. He didn't do a follow-up question. But in the end, I thought the interrogation was kind of pro forma. They didn't care about the interrogation. They wanted my stuff. That's what they wanted, and that's what they got. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, the detective who questioned me, by the way, they wouldn't give me their names either. The whole thing's crazy. Like, everything's secret. But he said, well, I don't really know who initiated this against you. He said, I'm just the messenger. I was told to stop you and do all this. I don't know who. You know, he may not have been telling the truth, but I kind of believe him. I kind of believe that, you know, he was told, go talk to this guy and take his devices and do all this. And he probably doesn't know who initiated it. And again, I'm sure that I will probably never know.
But it seems like intimidation, right?
Well, at least that. And I hope it's just that, you know, because Olga, you raised the specter of the U.S. maybe being behind it. If they were behind it, then I live in the United States. I'm in the United States right now. So what does that mean? I don't know. I'm obviously a little worried about what comes next because I don't know.
Well, you can always do a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request from the DOJ and FBI or State Department. But it seems to me if it was the U.S., you would have been flagged like Chris Halali was, where when you fly, like you're flagged by Interpol, and you were not. This was specifically the UK government. So I guess what I want to ask is...
That's what I think. Yeah, that's what I hope. Yeah. Yeah, no problems in Spain. So I flew to Spain first. No right. problems getting in and out of Spain. Then I flew to Liverpool, was stopped there. I had no problem leaving the UK, no problem flying from Liverpool to Dublin. So I had no problem in Ireland. And I had no problem getting through U.S. Customs and Immigration in the Dublin airport. As you know, they have pre-clearance there. So you're right. Mm-hmm. I hope it is just the U.K. I don't need to go there again, you know, so it's fine.
Was this legal overreach? You're an attorney. Was this legal overreach by the British government? And do you have grounds to sue them because they took your attorney-client product? I mean, you could. Right?
I think the answer is yes and yes. And in fact, I talked to a British lawyer whose stuff was taken. He is suing over that. So I do think I have grounds, and I am going to talk to his lawyers in the United Kingdom about a possible suit. Not just for me. I mean, look, I'm happy to kind of let things go in a way, but I think it needs to be fought for other people. You know, it's just this precedent can't be allowed to stand. And again, it seems like they were doing this to British people, and now they're starting to go beyond that, right? I may be their test case, mm-hmm. so I need to treat it as such and to fight back. And I think, you know, I've been very public in the media about what happened, as you know, and in social media and with this interview. And I think that's important, you know. There was a lawyer in Britain says, oh, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't be posting about this. It's like, why? It's not a secret. They want it to be a secret. They don't want accountability, right? Mm-hmm. So it's my job to make them accountable and to publicize this, you know?
I'm worried that you gave them your DNA. I don't know how Olga feels, but I won't give anybody my DNA, not willingly. They have to arrest me to give it. I mean,
they said they would arrest me.
If you didn't give your DNA. Because they could put
their DNA
anywhere.
You know, everything that I gave was given under duress. Everything was, I was threatened. You know, it was this kind of bizarre thing. You're not under arrest. You're being detained. However, and given that, they said, given that you're not under arrest, you cannot refuse to answer questions because you don't have a right against self-incrimination because you're not under arrest. But you also can't refuse to give your devices. refuse fingerprints or refuse DNA sample. If you do, we will arrest you. And, you know, the idea of being arrested in a foreign country, I didn't know what, you know, at that point, I was willing to give up my DNA. I mean, by the way, they probably could have gotten it without even asking me. They kept giving me water. You know, they probably could have just taken my cup.
Yeah.
And done it that way. Yeah. So again, what is
they
this all about?
I don't even.
Yeah. So what is this all about? I don't know what this all is all about. And again, we're entering a period of increased repression in the West. All of the pretense about freedom and free speech and democracy, they're not even claiming they care about that anymore. And that, by the way, it raises the issue you raised at the outset, and that's the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States. I mean, honestly, a lot of us felt there wasn't a lot to celebrate there. No. You know, I mean, I don't feel
that's what I was actually going to ask you about, Daniel. So, I mean, what are your emotions about the path that the United States did throughout these 250 years? At what stage of development, so to say, of democracy are they now?
Yeah, well, I would say I'm disappointed. I mean, look, obviously I can point out the obvious things, that it was founded, you know, on the backs of slaves and the genocide of the Native Americans, which is all true, but there was progress. I mean, and again, I am willing to judge countries, including my own, in terms of the trajectory that they were on, right? There was progress. There was a civil war to end slavery. Slavery did end. There was a long path then for African Americans to get the right to vote, a long path for women to get the right to vote, but those things did happen, right? There was incremental and sometimes big leaps in progress, and I recognize those things and I celebrate those things. But I feel the trajectory we are on now is going backwards. I don't feel we're becoming more free, we're becoming less free. We now have these crazy ICE guys running around like Gestapo, detaining all sorts of people, including U.S. citizens, sending some to this gulag, forgive me for that term, in El Salvador, right? I don't think we're on a trajectory towards freedom. We're on a trajectory towards repression. And so I don't feel like celebrating, you know, the Constitution, because I don't think it's being followed, you know. I think the things we took for granted are being eroded very quickly.
Ironically, on the very same day when the United States was celebrating its 250th anniversary, there was a funeral of the murdered Iranian leader. On the same day.
Yes.
And we could see, you know, millions, I think dozens of millions of people mourning in Iran, in Tehran, in other cities. They're just, the streets were just flooded by crowds of people who came into the streets to show their support of the murdered Supreme Leader. And in the United States, it was the Independence Day, and that was the country that murdered the Iranian leader, right?
Well, yes, and you know, to go even farther back, it was the U.S. that derailed Iranian democracy in 1953 by overthrowing their democratically elected prime minister, right? I mean, the hypocrisy is incredible. I think it's the hypocrisy that I can't stand, you know. You're told one thing and you get the other. So, yeah, I was in Chicago for the 4th of July, and I went to bed early. I didn't pay attention to the fireworks or anything. I mean, I just, you know. Anyway, my big holiday has never been the 4th of July. It's November 7th, 1917, I'm more interested in. That was a real revolution, by the way. So, I'll be celebrating that.
But Daniel, but now, you know, Trump has called communism the biggest threat for the United States after the Second World War. And I mean, I guess he was not only, you know, referring to the Americans. He was also speaking about, I don't know, Russia, since now NATO recognized in the recent NATO summit, recognized Russia as the biggest threat. So do you think he was addressing Russia as well?
Well, he might have been, because he's confused. He probably thinks the Soviet Union still exists, you know, as some people do. They don't really know. Americans in general don't know their history. They don't, you know. He's probably addressing China, you know, of course, which truthfully, you know, if one is just to be totally honest about it, I mean, the Communist Party has done incredible advances in that country, probably that the world has never seen in such a short time. You know, the Soviet Union was very, I think, a close maybe second to that. But what China's done is incredible. So I think it's a threat to, you know, the ruling trillionaires and billionaires. But I see that as a good thing, of course. I think they're the threat to humanity. That's who's threatening humanity right now, are the billionaires and the trillionaires. And they're the ones destroying the environment and leading us into war and building these crazy AI, you know, data centers. And, you know, it's really something that, you know, Isaac Asimov was warning about, you know, a long time ago.
You know, that brings me, you mentioned the data centers. There is a globalist plan, apparently through the World Economic Forum, if you read their website, about 2030, something happening to humanity in 2030, and the data centers are part of that. So I kind of feel like, do you feel like that we're frogs in the boiling water? You know, that saying where slowly things are happening around us, they're moving around us. Like what you just went through is like a microcosm of the macrocosm of that repression that's coming. But it's going to be really significant in about 5 to 10 years. That's kind of my read on it. What's your read?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to put it. I think, look, some people are really experiencing it right now. Again, if you're a Latino in this country right now, you're experiencing it with the ICE detentions. You know, you're really, yeah, it's an everyday thing for you. African Americans, I think, have always felt that. For people like me, it's easy, as you say, to kind of go about your life, go to the movies, watch TV, whatever, and life can go on for you. But yeah, you're going to wake up and all those freedoms that you thought you had are going to be gone. I do see that happening, unless there's resistance. And again, that's what they're trying to get ahead of. They're trying to get ahead of resistance, and they're worried about people who they see as you know, being, you know, leaders of that resistance, and they're going to go after them first. So I do think, you know, that's what we're seeing with what's happening at the border areas. And what they're doing, you know, they're doing at the border areas what they can't, they don't think they can do yet anyway, outside the border area, right? I know it works in the U.S. Until you cross the border, and that means in the airport, until you get through the double doors through immigration and customs, you're not considered to be in the United States of America. You are considered to be at the border and not to have full constitutional rights. So they have figured out that, oh, well, this is great. We can do all sorts of things to people, even U.S. citizens, that we could never do outside the border area, certainly without a warrant, right, and without some probable cause. We can take your phones. We can take your computer. We can interrogate you for hours on end without an attorney. I think they figured this out, and I think the Brits have figured it out, and that's what's happening. So travel, international travel is becoming very risky. I mean, I certainly feel that way. I now have to think very long and hard about the trips I make because, you know, they put me at peril. And like, you know, they put, you know, like-minded people at peril. So, and that's another reason I'm being very public about this. People need to know what their risks are if they are, you know, activist or whatever. They need to know this could happen to them. They need to think about not bringing their phones on trips. They maybe get a burner phone, right? That sort of thing. People need to be very intentional about traveling. Again, especially if they're people who are activists.
Daniel, but also the year of 2030, which Tara just mentioned, we've heard, for example, the German chief of army who was saying that Germany, for example, Europe should prepare for the war with Russia by the year of 2030. And now there is a NATO summit in Turkey, and they're also calling Russia the biggest threat. So do you think this year of 2030 is where NATO is really preparing for the war with Russia or planning the war with Russia? What do you think about that?
I mean, to me, it seems like a long time to plan for a war, like, and also to tell your so-called enemy that you're doing it. Hey, we'll see you in 4 years.
Yeah.
Okay, get ready. That doesn't seem very smart to me. I mean, I think if they're going to do it, they'll do it before then for that reason, right? Generally, people don't telegraph when they're going to attack you. And I know the Russians know it could happen any day. I mean, that's just a fact. I'm sure they know it's already happening with Ukraine. They know this is a Western attack on them, right? This is Operation Barbarossa 2.0. And the question is when it becomes, again, more direct, but it's certainly very indirect support that Ukraine's getting to now attack the homeland of Russia, of course. I saw those pictures of Moscow with the black smoke over the whole city, and when an oil refinery was hit by Ukrainian drones, certainly with help of U.S. and British intelligence, I'm certain they helped them target Moscow for that. I mean, that's an act of war. And I should say that Russia's been amazingly restrained in all this. It's the only thing that's kept us from World War III. It's the only thing that's kept us from an exchange of nuclear weapons is that Russia has not been willing to risk that by counterattacking, which they certainly have the right to do.
Just President Putin is so patient. I think most of Russian people even, you know, they're pushing towards
for
revenge, but he's extremely patient. And I mean, he's been trying to be provoked on a number of occasions for decades. But by the way, speaking about those drone attacks on Moscow, I guess the situation here, you know, it's like what we saw at the funeral of at Ayatollah in Iran, you know, this unity of Iranian people caused, I mean, they were pushed together even further after their leader was murdered. You know, before that, some of them, they could have been discontent, you know, with the condition of the economy was, you know, but after his murder, they got really united and stood together. So I think now when they're bombing Moscow, for example, and I mean, they think that lacking petrol, people may rise against Putin, but what they reach is definitely the opposite, because Russian people are calling for revenge, but not rising against their leader, of course.
Yeah, and the same would happen in the United States. If the U.S. were directly attacked and that sort of attack, people would rally around the government. I mean, this is very natural. And this has always been the case, you know, when the Nazis bombed London, it did not lower resistance, it increased resistance. When the U.S. carpet bombed Vietnam, it didn't lower resistance, it increased it. I mean, again, anyone who knows anything about history knows that this is how things work. So, yeah, but it's a very dangerous time. And I think we all feel that. And again, I think the acts of repression against individuals is really a symptom of that, and part and parcel of what's happening in the West, which we all need to take note of, you know.
So speaking about repressions, I guess as a lawyer, you may be interested in following the court hearing of the Charlie Kirk murder. So what do you think about that? Because there's so many weird facts about this murder and the way the court hearings are being arranged. What do you think of that?
I must confess, I have not been following that the court proceedings there very closely. But what I know of what happened, it does seem like there's a bigger story here than just one kind of lone gunman type situation. I think we're going to learn that there are probably bigger forces behind what happened. That's my view. But that's not something I've had the time to follow at the present.
Well, on that, and Olga,
it seems to me they're definitely trying to hide something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that I agree. I agree with that. Yes.
And what Olga brought up is really interesting, because we just celebrated the 250th anniversary. And for me as an American, one of the reasons why I didn't feel like celebrating is because the blue and white country has basically infiltrated our government and now are merging military. And we had a guest, Olga and I had a guest, who was a former CIA analyst, Leia is her name, who talked about how this intermingling of military intelligence will be very difficult to be undone. Like, they're now saying in the U.S. government, they're saying, oh, well, we're not going to give any more money to Israel. Well, why would they need to give any more money to Israel if Israel's joining the American military? So in that thousand page...
It will be theirs.
Yeah. In that thousand page document that just got passed, that military spending bill, they put in there that IDF is going to be joining the U.S. military, but not just military, but intelligence, which means the CIA and the IDF, you know, and Mossad will be sharing it, mandated to share information. The U.S. will be mandated to share information with Israel. So from an American perspective, I mean, I can tell you how I feel. You can give me your opinion. It feels like our government's been soft-cooed, basically, with AIPAC.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I agree with that. Honestly, I believe the Republic fell when John F. Kennedy was killed in 1963, and I think that Israel had something to do with that, by the way. But yeah, for sure, this is a very undemocratic move. What is Congress is trying to do, they know that the sentiment is against giving aid to Israel now, right?
Right.
And so what they're trying to do is make it impossible to stop that money from flowing, as you say, by integrating the forces. And by the way, the one question I have, you know, we mentioned in terms of my being stopped in the UK, who ordered it? One other suspect, of course, is Mossad. I mean, that's another possibility as well. But as you say, they're linked, and now they're going to be linked under law. And so that will make it very hard to stop the constant flow of weapons and munitions and money to Israel.
Daniel, may I ask you, from a legal point of view, since you are a lawyer, you are an attorney, you are an advocate, and now in the contemporary world, we just don't have any laws anymore, it seems, right? We only have the power of the strongest, or the one who tries to be the strongest. As Trump once said, his only limit is his morality, which was also kind of a doubtful criteria. So can an attorney or a lawyer really do something in the world where the law does not exist anymore, it seems?
Yes, well, obviously the rule of law has been intentionally whittled away. There's no question about that. However, there is still a role for lawyers. In the U.S., we still have some rule of law left. We still have independent courts. They're becoming much less independent, and the Supreme Court is now pretty much entirely in the sway of Trump. But there's still work that can be done, and that is done by immigration lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, civil rights lawyers. It's not totally gone yet, but it is certainly on its way to being destroyed, the rule of law. But there's still some there. In terms of, though, international law, I definitely feel that is a place where it's almost impossible to make a difference, because that really has been destroyed. And again, very intentionally so. But yeah, there's always hope, and you know, you have to keep working and trying. And part of the job of a lawyer is to try to keep the rule of law, you know, to protect it. And that's what we try to do.
Thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure. You know, hey, despite all the harassment you get, it's still good to be on this side. It's still good to be a fighter and an advocate and to fight for the right cause. And you do that regardless of the risks and the consequences. That, as John F. Kennedy said, that is the essence of morality.
Are you writing any more books? And where can our listeners and viewers find you and find your work? Because you are a prolific writer.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yes, I have a book I'm writing with some other authors. It's going to be a huge book on the crimes of the CIA, which will be very interesting. Hopefully that'll come out this year. People can find, I've written actually my 10th book. I just came out, so I'm pretty proud of that. They can find me on Twitter at Daniel M. Kovalik. They can find me, my books at Amazon or Skyhorse Publishing, which is my main publisher. Please check them out. And you got that? That's my first book. And by the way, Olga, as I understand
I'm having it with me. It's called The Plot Scapegoat Russia.
That's great. I'm so glad you like that. I understand it's coming out in Russian in Russia very soon.
I think it really gives readers the understanding, you know, of why, I mean, they're calling Russia the biggest threat all the time, you know, how they make up this pretext. So this is, as for me, this is the book, the best book to explain that.
Thank you. That you made my day. Thank you very much for saying that.
Thank you for your courage, Daniel. And once again, I honestly think that you can find a much safer, first of all, place here in Russia, and my coach is always your coach.
And I appreciate that. I'm very grateful, and believe me, I may show up in Russia before you know it. So thank you. It is good to know there's a place I can go. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it, everyone. We really appreciate Daniel and Olga coming all the way from the Urals. Olga, this was an unusual format, but it's good for us to get used to it because, you know, sometimes we're going to be remote. So, although I like it when you're
but
next to
But the show
to
must
the
go on, you know, so
yes,
it will
yes.
go on.
We're looking forward to, our audience is looking forward to any pictures you have of the Urals as well. And Daniel, please, audience, like those of you watching, follow Daniel Kovalik and keep supporting him. It's not okay for lawyers, especially human rights lawyers that are trying to advocate for people to be held at borders and to have their, you know, their things confiscated. So we all must speak up. So, and those of you have that have been supporting our show, we really appreciate your comments. We appreciate all the kind words that you've been saying. And I know that someone asked if this was merch. We're working on it. But actually, this KGB
not yet, but it will be.
Yeah. But we will hopefully see you soon. So stay with us. Subscribe to YouTube. Subscribe to our channel on X.
Show must go on. Take care.
Take care.